You're listening to a recording from the Open Society Institute, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
I want to welcome you here this evening. This is an opportunity to listen to and to talk to Francisco Goldman, who has published a new book, The Art of Political Murder, Who Killed the Bishop. I think many people who are present here know quite a lot about the story of Bishop Haradi and about events in Guatemala. But I think that the conversation will be immensely interesting for all of us. Francisco Goldman is a Guatemalan-American author, a novelist up to this point. So far as I know, this is your first book of nonfiction. But it's written with the talent of a novelist and has the storytelling ability of a novelist. I'm going to ask Francisco Goldman to talk for a while about the book and about his work on the book, and then we've asked Juan Mendez to comment. Juan, who is also known to many of you, is the president of the International Center for Transitional Justice, and he was previously the special advisor to the Secretary General of the United Nations on the prevention of genocide, and he has also served as president of the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, and I had the opportunity to work with him for many years at Human Rights Watch. He directed the America's Watch division of Human Rights Watch and then served as general counsel of Human Rights Watch. And then we'll open it up for general discussion. Frank, the floor is yours.
Thank you, IA. Thank you, all of you, for coming.
Can everybody hear?
Can you hear me? All right. I guess I'm going to do, an abridged version.
By the way, let me make one comment first, which the lawyers insist that I make, and that is that the event is being recorded and will be available on OSI's website, so your participation in the conversation this evening constitutes your permission to have it recorded in this way.
I thought when you mentioned the lawyers were going to say anything libelous, I might say you were responsible for. I'm going to give it a bridged version then of the talk I usually give when I'm on tour, partly taking advantage of the fact that I think a lot of you don't need the usual background you'd give on Bishop Haradi in Guatemala in a bookstore or something. I'll just begin with how I got into this case. As you know, from a very young age, really, before I'd even graduated college, because I still had a little bit to go, in 1979, I began to write freelance journalism from Central America. I'd moved down to Guatemala from New York, really to apply to get a manuscript together to apply for a Master of Fine Arts program in the United States as a fiction writer, but I had a stroke of quite extraordinary luck, and some of those stories got published by a magazine up in New York, Esquire, so I had to choose between the offer of scholarships at a writing school or $1,000 freelance assignment to write about Guatemala for a magazine, and I chose the latter. And that really ended up defining the next 11, 12 years of my life. I think the last story I did a magazine piece on was probably the Panama invasion. But by the time then, the early 90s happened, I felt like I'd given a lot of myself and I'd learned so much. It had been my real, true university, that time spent down there. But I'd kind of had enough of it. Like a lot of people, I felt a little burnt out by the whole Central American story and a bit disillusioned. While most of my very close friends went off to the next war, the next war, the next war as journalists, I decided I just wanted to work on my fiction for all those years. And throughout the 90s, I did very little journalism. And then it so happened, when Bishop Harardi was murdered in the spring of 1998, April 26th, I was certainly aware of it, you know. And of course, he just presented this historic human rights report, which, acting at the margins outside the silence agreed upon by the amnesty that was agreed on in the peace accords in 96, he published this incredible human rights report. And he'd been, and 2 days after this Catholic Church Human Rights Report, which I'll talk a little bit more about later on, was presented. Of course, he's murdered, bludgeoned to death in his parish house church. And I said, well, it's the same old story. Obviously, the army whacked him. You know, what else is new? And I was far away and went on to other things. And then I happened to be in, a few months later, in Spain, in July, visiting my closest friend ever since the Central American days, John Lee Anderson, who's now, of course, you all know for his work in The New Yorker and Iraq and so forth. And I opened up El País, which is sort of like the Spanish paper of record, and there was this huge story that based on the findings of this very eminent Spanish forensic anthropologist, who, looking at autopsy photographs of Bishop Harardi's head, had discovered signs of dog bites. Bishop Harardi's co-parish priest, and there are pictures of him in the paper being led away in handcuffs, this pudgy 34-year-old priest in designer glasses and kind of European designer clothes, was being led away in handcuffs. He'd been captured in a commando operation in which 150 like heavily armed commandos had surrounded this parish church and arrested him in taking this German shepherd dog into custody as material evidence. And my reaction to this was, wow, that is fantastic. I mean, this is the last thing anybody would have expected. It was El País, so I thought it must be true. I had a kind of cynical glee, almost. I said, I would really like to go write about this. This is really a surprising turn of events. And John Lee said, why don't you write away to The New Yorker and see if they're interested? And we sent the fax, I remember, to the only person I knew there, Bill Buford, the fiction editor, who, being a very cynical person himself, liked the idea. And I was given the assignment, but on spec, which meant that I had to pay my own way. And if they eventually decided that they liked it, they would reimburse me and so forth. So I flew out of Guatemala. I'll never forget getting there. I had to stay in the usual, dump. I stayed in the Pension Suiza, which some of you must know, just like $3 a night down in Zone 1. And I remember that first night, I wanted to see the church, get a feel for what the church was like at the hour that the murder had taken place. So I took a taxi. And you have to know the neighborhood is very important in this story. San Sebastian Church is in the old Centro Histórico, the old downtown, in a neighborhood right by the National Palace and the famous, notorious military installations behind it. And it is an old, middle-class kind of residential neighborhood of old Spanish colonial-style homes where my own grandmother and my mother grew up. In fact, one of the crazy coincidences of the story is I was actually baptized in San Sebastian Church as a little newborn infant. At night, because of crime in the neighborhood and everything else, everything is shuttered, everything is dark, and there's a big park out front. And I remember I got there that night and instantly felt the fear. It was a misty night, and you'd look into the park, and I remember seeing there was this figure, and the figure was looking at me like, who are you? And I was looking at him, and I started to walk into the park, and cowardice overtook me, and I retreated, and he started to walk towards me. And anyway, he was a policeman in a bulletproof vest, and we walked back up in front of the parish house garage door. And it was inside that garage that Bishop Hardy was, of course, murdered. And sleeping in front of the church, and this is very important later on in the crime, exactly as the night the murder occurred, were all these sleeping vagrants, colloquially known in Guatemala as los bolitos, the little drunks, who were there in their little rags and their cardboard beds, sleeping in front of the entrance to the garage, and around it. And all of a sudden, they woke up like that, like dominoes. And they started like mocking the police and going, us, nosotros no vimos nada. We didn't see anything. And one of them rolled his fists like this and said, if I'd been here, I would have saved the bishop. And the policeman looked completely disconcerted by them. And it was kind of a chilling moment. And the next day I went and met a friend of a friend. I didn't really know him. A friend of Andy Kaufman's, who had worked at the Church Office of Human Rights, who was my connection to the Church Office of Human Rights. And we met for lunch, and the first thing he said to me was, no mames, you know, it wasn't dog bites, he said, you know, and it wasn't the pre, you know. And he began to tell me about a little bit of the evidence that so far early on filtered in to the Church Office of Human Rights in the case. And it just hit me like a ton of bricks. I just remember it came over me almost viscerally, like, oh, so it is the same old story. But it is the same old story at a level of sophistication and nastiness and strangeness like I'd never seen before. And I'll never forget leaving that lunch that day and walking through downtown Guatemala City. It was like a deja vu, like I was just stepping right back into the Guatemala of the 80s, mentally and emotionally. You know, this world of paranoia and game hall of mirrors and just sort of unpunished death and murder all around you in the air. And I knew then, by what my friend had told me, just instinctively, that sure, it had been the army, of course it had been. But how did this story get started? And what's really going on here? And that was, for me, the beginning of a 9-year involvement in this case. And really, you know, 9 years constantly living with this. This is a case, though in the end is in some ways the story of an incredible victory. It's a case that we didn't even know for sure was a victory till April of 2007, when the final sort of appeals hearing was heard and finally confirmed. And in between, the most perilous, constantly changing, constantly obstacle-filled, and most extraordinarily unusual legal fight you could imagine. You have to go back a minute to remember who Bishop Hardy was. I think most of you know that is 1980, in the late 70s, 1980, as Bishop of K'iche'. He was bishop in the province that saw a lot of the worst atrocities of Guatemala's war. In fact, the dioceses of K'iche' later became the dioceses which saw more priests, nuns, catechists, and so forth, eventually martyred than any other in Latin America. It was a time when they were going to get much worse, but the massacres and the repression in the highlands and repression against the church was really starting. They were killing Catholic church organizers, catechists, nuns, priests, and Bishop Hardy himself narrowly escaped an assassination attempt, which filled him, really frankly, with fear. And he made a momentous decision to close down the dioceses and pull out his priests and nuns for their own safety, he thought. And he flew to the Vatican to tell Pope John Paul II, to inform him. He was an old friend of the Pope's. They were kind of similar male figures, both of them rugged, earthy. They'd been friends since they were young bishops, meeting at international synods. And the Pope was outraged about what was happening in K'iche', and actually wrote an extraordinary letter of denunciation, which infuriated the right wing in Guatemala, who thought the Pope was an anti-communist like them, but he also ordered Gerardi to go back to Guatemala and reopen the diocese and bring back his priests and nuns. And he obeyed, and he got to the airport, and there was a contingent of military men waiting for him there who were undoubtedly going to kill him, except there was a contingent of bishops there too that saved him, and they put him on a plane to Salvador. He got to Salvador, and which had at that time a University of Notre Dame educated Christian Democratic president who got word to Gerardi that there was a death squad waiting for him there, and don't you dare get off this plane. And he went on to Costa Rica, where he spent 4 anguished, awful years feeling out of the fray, frustrated, guilty, while the slaughter went on unabated and increasing in intensity in Quiché. Finally, in 1984, the Guatemalan Cardinal Casallegos, who was your classic, the kind of guy, although he was very skinny, you picture the kind of corrupt fat Cardinal Botero would paint, going around town in a big limousine, never speaking out against the death of his own priests and nuns, blessing army tanks with holy water. He finally died, and Archbishop Penados, for reasons having to do with Rios Montt, was a Protestant, of course, having so strained relations between the military and the church. The new archbishop, who traded in the limousine and drove around in his own Toyota, invited Bishop Gerardi back to Guatemala. And among his appointments, he was the founder and director of the churches, the Guatemalan Archdiocese Office of Human Rights, which from here on out referred to as ODA, which was the first human rights group in Guatemala that could operate on a national level, because obviously through its network of parish churches and so forth throughout the country, whereas every other Guatemalan human rights group have, of course, been pretty much instantly wiped out through violent repression, like the GAM leadership, for instance, back there in the mid-80s. And the peace accords started to happen, and Bishop Gerardi was involved in the peace negotiations. And of course, those negotiations that finally had culminated in 96 with the army, because they were the victors in the war, dictating the terms, included a blanket amnesty, a so-called piñata of self-forgiveness for all human rights crimes. You know, there's a war, the 36 war that saw 200,000 civilians dead, and for which not a single Guatemalan military officer had ever faced trial for a human rights murder. Blanket amnesty for all those crimes, and said that there could be a kind of UN-sponsored truth commission, but that truth commission was not going to be allowed, you know, to name names or assign blame or even name military units. And Bishop Gerardi was very concerned about this, but what he saw as a whitewash, of course. And he also was worried that there were some of my friends here worked in that truth commission, a couple of you were here, that when that UN truth commission went up into the mountains, you know, these blonde, Ivy League, Yale Law School types, that they're going to get into these villages, which, as you know, the highland villages where the worst atrocities happened, and the massacres happened, these separate, isolated areas, like in a state of fear of outsiders, traumatized, confused over what had happened to them, and just completely locked into this fear of speaking out, a real taboo against speaking out for the trouble it could bring you to speak out. And Bishop Gerardi decided that he would therefore, the church would do its own human rights report. Because the church, after all, didn't sign the peace accords, could act independently of them. And the result of that was he trained 700 people who went out into all, you know, people who came from the church parishes, who went out into all the villages, or as many as they could, with their little tape recorders, and started to take testimony. And there were people who were known in those communities, and they were trusted, and they could break down those barriers. And the result was presented on April 24th, 1998, this unprecedented 4-volume human rights report that extraordinarily, out of the 600-plus massacres we now know occurred in Guatemala, managed to identify some 400 of them, managed to name 50, it's the whole fourth volume, 50,000 of the dead civilians, of the 200,000 we know died, managed to name them by name, all sorts of analysis of how the military intelligence apparatus worked. And as the bishop had said, I mean, in some ways it was like a work of literature. He had said that he wanted a report that would enter readers through their pores and move them. And I'll just read a tiny bit of this because, and just remember there were hundreds of pages of this in the report. I'll just read two little tiny sections of testimony. The senora was pregnant. With a knife, they cut open her belly to pull out her little baby boy, and they killed them both. And the muchachitas, playing in the trees near the house, they cut off their little heads with machetes. Case 0976, Santa Maria Sheja, Quiche, 1980. They killed them with machetes. They killed them by strangling them with bullets. They picked up the children by their legs and smashed them against a tree. And the tree they smashed the children against, that tree died. Because of so many children smashed against that tree so many times, well, the tree died. Case 336, Rio Negro, Rabinal, Baja Verapaz, 1982. Hundreds of pages like that. And he concluded that out of the 200,000 dead in Guatemala, the Guatemalan army had perpetrated 80% of those deaths, and the guerrillas only 5%. And he made it known, he did name names, he did name military units, and made it known that if the amnesty was ever breached, he had all this documentation which he would make available to prosecutors and to families seeking justice. So this was, imagine if you are one of the great Guatemalan military chiefs who negotiated this amnesty. This was the most extraordinary impertinence. They never expected to have to deal with something like this. Right? I mean, this was not foreseen in the peace accords, that something like this would be presented inside Guatemala, that would so directly challenge the amnesty and the Guatemalan army's position at the center of Guatemalan society. So there's a motive to see why Bishop Moriarty was murdered. Of course, the question everybody asks is why would they murder him 2 days after the report was released and not before it? And the answer to that question is to begin to answer to ask the question and then to start to answer it is to begin to answer why the book, for example, is called The Art of Political Murder. Because to have murdered him a couple of days before the report came out, or before the report came out, wouldn't have stopped the report from coming out. And it would have just made him a martyr and focused more attention on the report. So, you know, when Virginia Woolf says that a woman's one's own, right, is necessary for a fiction writer to sort of free their imagination and do their work, I always think the equivalent of that room of one's own to state-sponsored murderers is the institution of impunity. The fact that you know no matter what you do, you're not going to have to face justice, which frees your imagination to dream up the most extraordinary crimes. And we know that in the history of Guatemala, we have a long history of crimes that are pure theater, from Myrna Mack stabbing, faked crime of passion, and so forth. So when they looked at this problem they were facing coming from the church, they must have said to themselves, what if we can do a murder that doesn't just eliminate this person we hate, our opponent, Bishop Moriarty, who has dared to defy us in this way, but what if we can do it in such a way that we discredit him, create such a scandal that it discredits him, the Catholic Church, the report itself, and is rigged up so that sort of the more the church struggles against it, the more scandal about the church will come out, and we'll have this on-running soap opera It'll go for months and months, years and years, and spread confusion everywhere. What if we can do something like that? So look how the murder happened. Theater from the get-go. Hours before the murder, somebody walks into the park. This is known. A guy known to the vagrants. He's carrying a gift of uncapped liter bottles of beer and Kraft cheese sandwiches. Not the usual thing, as one of them said later. Which, of course, we know now were laced with soporifics of some kind. Knocked most of them out, although a lot of them saw more than they wanted to admit. A couple of these so-called vagrants knew they weren't supposed to partake of this stuff. 10 o'clock that evening, Bishop Harardi, every Sunday night, used to go home, used to go to his sister's, have dinner with his elderly sister and his nephew and some of his family members. Always came back around 10 o'clock at night. So that night, as always, his car comes up the drive at about 10 o'clock. When he would pull into that drive, it's that dark, dark park I described, he would always have to idle his car in front of the garage door, get out, open a little door in the garage, step through it, haul open this very clunky accordion-like metal garage door, go back out to the driveway, drive his car inside, get out, turn off the car, and shut, pull this door shut. Presumably that's what happened that night, but probably not. 10.05 p.m., the door is shut. I don't think it was Bishop Harardi who closed it. The door opens. A shirtless man steps out. As you all know, Guatemala is a cold, chilly city at night. People don't go around without shirts on. Right? This muscular young man in his late 20s or so steps out of the door, allowing himself to be seen, and walks away. Inside, he's left a sweater on the floor beside the battered, bludgeoned body of Bishop Harardi. The vagrant, or two of the vagrants who hadn't partaken of the drugged food, of course, are there to see the shirtless man display himself. When the co-parish priest, Padre Mario Orantes, discovers the body an hour or two later and finally calls the police, we soon get a completely overrun crime scene. People from the church arrive, people from all over arrive. The police put the security tape only around the body when the whole church, the whole park should have been sealed off, of course. Right? Blood being tracked everywhere, evidence completely being wiped out. They would have chosen that night knowing that the prosecutors go by rotation. So they would have known prosecution team six was that this case was going to fall to prosecution case six beforehand. At 5 in the morning, Padre Mario Orantes begins to mop up the garage, getting rid of whatever evidence, more evidence that might be there, supposedly on orders from somebody from the public ministry. You and investigators, as they're leaving the park, are surprised to hear one of the female vagrants chanting, "Fueron huecos, fueron huecos." It was fags that did it. It was fags that did it. In the autopsy room, one of the prosecutors walks in and says, "Anal swab to check for signs of homosexual penetration. Orders from above." The next morning at a cabinet meeting, General Espinoza, the highest ranking member of President Arzu's military team, tells the president and the cabinet, "This is very sensitive information. We have to be very careful with this, because the country's shocked, beloved Catholic bishop, but we have information that this was a lío entre homosexuales. This was the result of a homosexual squabble, a domestic crime." Soon this begins to trickle out into diplomatic circles, business circles. You know how people love to be in the know and say, you know, "I've heard what really happened here is, I have good sources that," right? Gets into the media. All of this, pure theater, culminates 3 months later. There's a lot more steps that I could describe when I open that newspaper, and there it is, Padre Mario under arrest, charged as being the sole murderer of Bishop Girardi in a domestic crime of passion. Now, if you're the guys from the Guatemalan Catholic Church, or anybody who wants to see justice done in this case, who is going to do justice? Where are you going to get it from? The police, in the 9 years I covered this case, never contributed anything. They did nothing. The police are in the hands of higher-up people. Who's going to do it? What can you possibly do? The whole system is rigged up not to do justice, but to prevent justice. You have a corrupt prosecution team, you have corrupt media, you have very corrupt judge presiding over the case initially. You know, how do you fight against it? That night, that very night, as they sat there stunned, the young people from the Guam, and this is a story of young people all the way through, the story, the young people from the Church Human Rights Office decided very, quixotically, that they were going to form their own investigation team. That they had their team of lawyers, and they would investigate the case themselves. These are the famous untouchables, as they self-mockingly called themselves. It was started by a 28-year-old kid. This is really a hilarious story. Fernando Penados, nephew of the Archbishop. When he was a teenager, he'd been brought up by his family, a very religious family. They thought he would be a priest. They wanted him to be a priest. He was the elder born son. But he was a wild kid. So what are we going to do with Fernando? So they sent him to live in the Archbishop's palace and to share a room with a seminarian. And as Fernando himself puts it, I never understood very well the process in which I was immersed, and the seminarian ended up leaving the seminary. Fernando would take the poor seminarian out drinking and God knows where else, and said Fernando was smuggling girls back into the Archbishop's palace. I said, okay, Fernando's never going to be a priest. What can we do with him? And they sent him to work with Bishop Girardi. And Bishop Girardi started to train him investigating human rights crimes, which is the best education you could get in criminal investigation in Guatemala, because you sure weren't going to get one from the police. And he fell in love with that kind of work. In that time, everyone was offering courses, so he got to take an FBI course through the U.S. Embassies, a Sûreté course through the French, a Spanish Civil Guard course through the Spanish Embassy. He ends up being an investigator for the public ministry, which is like the district attorney's office, and teaches a course in the National Police Academy. He's prepared to do this. He's 28 years old. He comes back to form a team to look into the death of his old mentor. But the team is completely amateur. He invites his friend Arturo, who was working at a gas plant, a 19-year-old kid named Arturo Aguilar, who was a law student who was already still living at home and doing volunteer work at the ODA. And one day when he was driving to the morgue and knew it would smell bad and he needed cigarettes, he saw a very handsome, lanky kid smoking a cigarette in the courtyard of the ODA. This kid's nickname, because of his good looks and long hair, was El Shakira. He invited him to join the team because he wanted his cigarettes. And believe it or not, in ways I won't go into now, if it hadn't been for these four kids, railroading Padre Mario Orantes into jail as the sole killer would have been a slam dunk. They miraculously, and I was there, by this time I had arrived in Guatemala and had, through a lot of persistence, become friendly with them and was accompanying them all the time. And I was there when they brought in the first very key witness in the case, and was hair-raising what happened, because it became known that a taxi driver had seen, it's a wonderful story, but I want to hurry along now, who had seen the shirtless man that night, because he had pulled over to the church late at night to smoke a joint, and he looked up and he saw this shirtless man standing standing on the corner outside a white Toyota Corolla with other men standing around him, and another Toyota Corolla went by against the one-way traffic the wrong way, and he was sure they were undercover cops doing a bust, and he memorized the plate number in case he ever saw them again, because he was a drug user. And he passed that plate number to the OTA, and anyway, anonymously, through another priest. And when I got there, everybody was looking for this taxi driver, and taxi drivers were turning up dead because people thought they had gotten the right taxi driver, and it wasn't the right taxi driver, and it was just the typical Guatemalan horrific thing. And I was there when they found the real taxi driver. And they managed to pull in some of the key witnesses in the case. They managed to, through an extraordinarily dramatic exhumation, which that scenario of the dog bites was refuted, and then a very brave, singular prosecutor, no, another prosecutor took over, and he was an honest prosecutor, and he was about to issue arrest warrants for military men in the case, and he made it very clear that they were going to abduct his children. And so he fled the country. And then another extraordinary prosecutor came in, Leopoldo Zasig, and he endured the most hair-raising threats, he and his wife and their infant child, for 2 years. And he brought in, I think, the two most important witnesses in the case. And the case, as you know, in 2001, went to trial. And it was an extraordinary a victory, despite the fact that, you know, the day the trial was supposed to begin, they set off two grenades in the yard of one of the female judges who was to try the case. And Zasig told me, you know, he was, you know, they blew out her rear windows and her gas tank. And Zasig told me he was sure she was going to fly immediately into exile, and there'd be yet another postponement of months and months. But she walked in that morning and said, no matter what it takes, we're going to see this through. It's the kind of heroism that spread throughout this case. A young woman in her 30s. And there were the trial resulted in very historic convictions of three military men, the father and sons, Colonel Byron Lima and his son, Captain Byron Lima, Sergeant Major Villanueva, and the priest, the mysteriously complicit, utterly blackmailed, but guilty, Father Mario Orantes. Now, this is the last point I want to make. That should have been a great victory for Guatemala. All of Guatemala should have been able to sit back and say, in the worst circumstances, when it seems like it's impossible to achieve, you know, if enough people are willing to endure the risks and the dangers and have the conviction, we can get a verdict like this. But the saddest thing, and one of the saddest things I've ever lived through, was the manner in which that was prevented from happening. Almost overnight, and this defined the last 6 years of the case. And the last 6 years of the case are more frightening and more dangerous and more frustrating than the first 3 years, when the most extraordinary propaganda campaign that operated on so many levels was launched in Guatemala to discredit the verdicts and to, in fact, convince most Guatemalans that the actual guilty people were the young people from the OTA. When the Inter-American Court of Human Rights took the Myrna Mack case, they issued an extraordinary 200-page verdict where they talked about political murders in Guatemala. And they said a political murder in Guatemala has three stages. The first stage, which is the planning stage, the second stage, which is the carrying the murder out, and the third stage. And the third stage is as much a part of the murder as the first two stages. And the third stage involves defamation campaigns, disinformation campaigns, manipulation of, you know, placing corrupt judges in the appeals courts, and so forth. And where the Bishop Herardi murder case was a masterpiece of the art of political murder, was especially in that third stage, where they spread so much confusion about the crime against throughout Guatemala that to this day, a majority of Guatemalans, as Fernando Pinales puts it late in the book, ask them about the Hardy case, and they have no fucking idea what happened. And all of this, it's important to understand why this was done. Because the verdict in the Hardy case asked for open investigations against higher-ups in the case. And when you go after higher-ups in a case like this, you're getting into the heart of the way power really works in Guatemala. And you're bridging in terms of how what has happened in Guatemala, you're really crossing that bridge from 1980s-style political violence to 21st-century organized crime, right? Where the military intelligence units of the past, which were empowered by the CIA and so forth to fight guerrillas and run death squads for political reasons, once peacetime comes, desperately hold on to their power at the heart, their clandestine power at the heart of Guatemalan state. Why? For political reasons? Of course not. Because now, having your hands on that kind of clandestine power is the key to being central players in the narco trafficking trade and all the other organized crime rackets which have so buffeted Guatemala in contemporary times. So that when somebody like Bishop Girardi, whose church report, of course, led to the UN report a year later, helped trailblaze the way for them, which results in a declaration of genocide against the Guatemalan army and a breaching of the amnesty for crimes against humanity, when he's threatening human rights trials, what he's actually threatening is the contemporary hold on power. And that contemporary hold on power is all about crime. And so when the Bishop Girardi case advances to a stage where you can go up and you can start to get generals and former military intelligence chieftains, you're crossing over into the territory of organized crime. And so everything was done, and everything continues to be done, to keep this verdict from going forward. Though finally, in April of 2007, when the final rubber stamp from the Constitutional Court came down, the way, at least legally, was cleared for those investigations finally to go forward. I'll stop there.
Okay. Thank you very much. As you can see, Francisco Goldman knows how to tell a story. Juan Mendez is going to comment. Juan?
Thank you. I'm really grateful to ARIA and to Open Society for inviting me to comment on this and particularly to listen to this wonderful story. Even after having read the book, it's great to listen to the summary of it again. I also want to thank Francisco for having sent me the galleys of the book. I very seldom get books in galleys form, but this one I read with so much interest, and I was so caught by it that I have to recommend it to everybody. And the reason I got the reason I got caught in the reading was, of course, that in the 90s I lived in Central America, working for the Inter-American Institute of Human Rights, and I traveled extensively in Guatemala then, and I had the immense pleasure of meeting Bishop Girardi, because he had very close friends among my colleagues in the Inter-American Institute of Human Rights, and I say it was a very distinct pleasure to just even share a meal with him, with his good humor and his salt of the earth ability to tell stories as well. And I remember very distinctly that in April of 98, I went to the cathedral in Guatemala for the presentation of the REMI report, which was an incredibly hopeful moment. And only less than 2 days later, I had to go back to the cathedral to attend the wake of Bishop Girardi. But in 1996, I was there also at the palace next door to the cathedral when the peace accords were signed, and that was one of these few and far between hopeful moments that Guatemala sometimes have. This was, as you remember, a UN-brokered peace agreement, and it was one of the first experiences of the UN participating in a peace agreement with the kind of things that we now expect the UN to do. For example, monitoring on the ground, insisting on justice with peace, and not sacrificing justice for the sake of impunity. So all those expectations that peace with justice could be achieved in Guatemala were in 1996 an incredible moment of hope. You will remember that the amnesty that was passed as a result of the peace agreements was probably the first one in recent vintage, in Latin America at least, that was actually limited, that did not include crimes against humanity or war crimes, however defined. And so it was something that now, only a few years later, the United Nations adopted as a doctrine that its mediators will not accept amnesties that have the effect of making it impossible to prosecute war crimes and crimes against humanity. And the first case of this was Guatemala. Also, the peace accords had an incredibly progressive clause in the recognition that Guatemala was a multicultural state, recognition of the several languages that are spoken by indigenous communities in Guatemala, and the promise was that the indigenous population, for the first time in literally hundreds of years, were going to be recognized as first-class citizens as everybody else. And then there was the promise of the truth-telling exercise with United Nations support, even though they tried not to call it truth-telling and instead call it Commission of Historical Clarifications. But the results, as Francisco points out, are extremely disappointing, because in spite of the fact that the amnesty law allows for prosecutions of the most serious crimes, in fact there have been almost no prosecutions of any of the massacres of the dirty war years in the highlands. The multiculturalism clause was defeated in a plebiscite with the army institutionally campaigning very hard to tell Guatemalans that it was an assault on the nationality and on the nation itself to accept a clause that simply recognized the multiculturalism of Guatemala. On the truth-telling, I think we have some better results, especially in the REMI report and in the report of the Commission on Historical Clarification. And as has been pointed out, this is one of the few reports sponsored by the United Nations that actually dares to use the G word, the genocide word, to qualify what took on. But the most important thing is it's done with such abundance of evidence and such fine and thorough legal analysis of the evidence that is completely irrefutable. Edited by famous professor Ben Kiernan, Yale University Press is going to publish some materials that were gathered by the Commission on Historical Clarification, and it's going to be coming out very soon. But unfortunately, the recommendations of these truth-telling reports have not been implemented in any serious way. I think the reason is what Francisco has just said. The powers that be in Guatemala are not just the army, although the army continues to be a power unto itself and with a completely unaccountable institution. But the powerful sectors of Guatemala have an ability to reign by fear and ruthlessness of the most savage way. Especially during the campaign in the highlands in the 70s and 80s, it was shown that this incredible campaign easily cost about 200,000 lives, according to the UN report. But the powerful sectors also have an ability to reign by deceit, by pretense, by signing on the dotted line and then pretending that what is in the paper does not mean what it says, by its ability to accept rules and conditions of democracy and then delete them in practice and obfuscate them and obscure them. And it is even by the corruption of language that the powerful sectors of Guatemala deceive the population, but also pretend that they do something when they're actually doing exactly the opposite, in this kind of Orwellian way in which truth means just the consecration of the accepted lies and justice means impunity. I think the choice of title that Francisco has chosen, The Art of Political Murder, exemplifies this combination of ruthlessness with this really sophisticated way of obfuscating everything. So because of that, the system in Guatemala has been able to frustrate not only investigations and trials, but even the most minimal court reform, which was supposed to have happened in these years, has also failed to produce any serious system of justice that one can have any rely on in any serious way. And in the frustration of this, the democratic sectors, which of course there are and many in Guatemala, and this with this critique I'll include several of our colleague human rights organizations, go from the extremes of radicalism and rejection of any and all measures, distrust of anything that is offered to them, to extremes of accommodation to circumstances. And by accommodation to circumstances, I mean this false realism that sends some people, makes some people believe that that it's okay to live with injustice and with powerlessness. That is basically all that can be achieved. It reminds me that when Vinicio Cerezo was elected president after the series of military governments, he told everybody that he had only 30% of the power after being popularly elected, and that he hoped to achieve some percentage higher than that. In fact, at the end of his government, if he had 30% of the power, we were very lucky. He had actually relinquished any moral authority and any ability to control the forces that really govern in Guatemala. And I think sometimes the international community has been guilty of allowing our friends in Guatemala to be this passive and not demanding more. At the same time, as I said, the 1996 was one of those rare moments of hope, but there's been others and we should remember them. And I think this book by Francisco Goldman reminds us that there are moments of hope and reasons to have moments of hope. And just to mention a few, I would definitely mention the period of the governments of Arevalo and Arbenz in the late 40s and early 50s, ended in a CIA-sponsored coup in 1954. But also, much, much later, the defeat of the self-coup by Jorge Serrano in 1993, I think it was 1993, in which the institutions, but also the people, prevented self-proclaimed dictator from canceling the parliament and the judiciary and imitate Alberto Fujimori and stage a self-coup. The institutions functioned in 1993 in Guatemala. And then another moment of hope is, of course, the REMI project and its report. And this reminds me that also that the Catholic Church in Guatemala, beyond the REMI report, had already in previous years, mostly with the support of Gerardi, but also of others, done incredibly courageous work. I remember the investigation in the villages in the highlands by the Jesuit priest Ricardo Faja, that was also published as a book later on. But I remember my own anecdote when I was doing some work for Human Rights Watch, then America's Watch, and I was driving around small villages, not very far from the capital of Guatemala, and I almost stumbled into a parish, and there was an Italian parish priest there who, after warming up to me, I suppose, after a long conversation, he actually opened the parish books to me and read from years before the events, like a diary that he had been recording with the incredible violations that had occurred in this parish that I found almost by chance driving around Guatemala in the 90s already. I think another, despite what Francisco says, the trial and conviction of the murderers of Juan Gerardi is another hopeful moment. We should vindicate it, and we should keep it, because it does show the path to what can happen in Guatemala and will happen someday. And I would just finish with today's possibilities offered by the CSIG project, again with UN support, that has been approved. This is a four-year-old project, and it was only approved this year after miraculously overcoming Rios Montt's objections and his party's objections in Parliament. We have to be careful, because it will be presented as just another crime-busting technique, which, calls the question, why would the United Nations be involved in crime-busting? In fact, it's not crime-busting. It's supposed to try to dismantle the criminal elements that are inherited from the infamous Estado Mayor Presidencial, that is, the presidential chiefs of staff that operated through all of these years, were abolished only a few years ago, and that were and are very aptly described in Francisco's book as having participated directly or indirectly in the murder of Bishop Gerardi. It's CSIG has as its objective, by using criminal investigations, the dismantling of all these organized crimes operations that are directly linked to the security forces of Guatemala via the Estado Mayor Presidencial. It's in that way that it is supposed to bust crime. It is supposed to focus precisely on those groups that are still active, so it probably won't go back too far into crimes of the past. But if it does concentrate under Spanish prosecutor Carlos Castresana on crimes committed by groups of this kind of origin, I think it does have a chance to put Guatemala in a very different path. So I think this book, painful as it is to read, and in the sense that it reminds us that there are forces that are so obscure and so complicated to dismantle that have the ability to frustrate what Guatemala could be, it is also a source of inspiration, hopefully inspiration to Castresana and the CSIG, but mostly inspiration to all other Guatemalans to insist on reform, to insist on justice, to insist on breaking the cycle of impunity. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. Okay, the floor is open. So, questions? And if you ask a question, I'd appreciate it if you'd go to the microphone. Mariam?
Hi, Francisco. Nice to see you here. I'd be curious to know what reaction, if any, there has been in Guatemala to your book, both by people that you talked with and who felt great hope in the fact that you were going to tell this story. And also, I assume the military sees you as no dear friend of theirs, and I wonder if you've heard anything in terms of the government or the military's reaction.
Yeah, there's been a lot of reaction. on the positive side, as you say, I think one reason I was able to get so close to some of the people in the book was, aside from the years we'd spent working on it together, not just the guys from the
from the Oda, but the good prosecutors and some of the very brave young journalists who work on the case, one of whom was here, who's a Claudia Mendez, who's a major figure in this story, and she's really typical of the people in this case who made it happen. People who devoted, I mean, I'm talking about people in their 20s, so I've met Claudia when she was 23, and she's just started reporting on the case, and for all those years, she was the only journalist in Guatemala telling the truth about this case, and had her, she was smeared so many times, attacked so many times, but she's really one of the people who make this, I think, made this for me the most incredibly inspiring story to work on. And we all became very, very close. And one of the reasons for that is I know that, you know, they, at a certain point, they trusted me to get their story out in the midst of all these propaganda campaigns. I'm very happy to say they've had this book since June. We even know that they had stolen copies of the book. One illegally downloaded from the internet. People saw the PDFs, right, Claudia? And they haven't been able to refute one single thing in it. They've smeared me a lot. And mainly, though, a lot of attention has been paid in the press to just a couple of paragraphs in the book. And I think it's understandable why these paragraphs would be such a big deal, because they implicate Otto Perez Molina, the current candidate for president, a former head of the EMP, Estado Mayor Presidencial. And so it makes sense that people would obsess on that. But I think also, because it's not really what the book is about, it's been a way of trying to distract attention from what the book actually, the information that the book actually gives. That's really solid evidence against a lot more people than the three people who went to jail. So, yeah, it's been making a lot of noise in Guatemala.
Steve Schlesinger, and I think most of you know that Steve was the co-author of Bitter Fruit, the book about the CIA coup in Guatemala.
Congratulations on your book. And
thank you.
What I was wondering is there another hopeful note in the sense that the United Nations, the Organization of American States, and the Catholic Church are now more directly involved in the affairs of Guatemala today, as countervailing influences on the government, and does that demonstrate real possibilities for the future?
I'll let Juan answer this, except to say that I agree with him. When you read this book, you see that as brave as the Guatemalans in the Haradi case were, this case never could have prospered without the involvement of the UN. At the fundamental level of keeping people alive. And I think that it's been, since Minugua, the UN mission, left a few years ago, it's been a very dangerous, perilous, little Death Valley, sort of. And I'm so happy that the UN is coming back, in a sense, in the shape of CICIGS, which Juan can talk more about. I agree that CICIGS is extremely hopeful for Guatemala. It's not going to be easy, if CICIGS is really going to work, they're going to be going after people who are so incredibly ruthless. You know, it's one thing to go after captains and even certain retired colonels. As we know from Colombia and Mexico, when you start really treading on the toes of real narco power, there are people who stop at nothing. But that's the battle that's shaping up. You want to say something about that?
On that, I think Minugua is one of the missions where the United Nations stayed the longest in any country, and yet it left too early. I think the same can be said, for example, of East Timor, where the fact that the UN left too early led to new, you know, conflict and violence later on. But I think, unfortunately, that's part of the problems that the United Nations has. I mean, it has very little way of sustaining presence, even when it's clear that it's having good results. Obviously, the UN is not much more than what the member states wanted to be, and Guatemala is a member state. So it has its own difficulties in performing its job. But hopefully, with CSIGs, signals another entry point for the United Nations. I would hope that it is sustained and supported at the level that it needs to be sustained, because otherwise it is a way of setting up Carlos Castresana for failure. But I think it's also up to us to make the United Nations live up to what it should be doing.
Other questions? Or?
Why do you think the United Nations needs?
Can you go to the microphone?
Just to follow up of what you said, why do you think that United Nations leaves?
Why they left?
Yeah. Or in the example you were giving in East Timor and in Guatemala or any other places, that they need to stay but they leave.
I'm sure there are many different reasons, and the reasons are very context-related, so it's impossible to say. But I think, unfortunately, the UN is always under pressure to wrap up and go to the next conflict, and it's very understandable. There are new conflicts that call upon the UN resources. But unfortunately, if you analyze conflict by conflict, the result is that the presence is not as strong as it should be, and not as long and sustained as it should be.
Okay, if there are no further questions, I'm going to thank our speakers and welcome all of you to a glass of wine and whatever other refreshments are available. Thank you very much.
Thank you.